Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of May. Senate Democratic leaders yesterday said they would not provide the $80 million that President Obama requested to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. The pressure is on the president, who's about to deliver a major speech on this issue, and we are monitoring. We didn't know it was going to happen at the same time as our show when Rob booked the show yesterday, so we're monitoring the speech. So our guests can almost simultaneously react to what the president has to say. Robert Gibbs, his press secretary, said yesterday Obama is going to be presenting a hefty part of his plan for closing Guantanamo and what will happen to them, to the 240 suspects who are still held there, during his speech, which will be coming up momentarily. Our guest this hour is Professor Stephen Vladek. He's associate professor at the American University Washington College of Law, teaches and does research focusing on federal jurisdiction, national security law, constitutional law, and international criminal law. He's a nationally recognized expert on the role of the federal courts in the war on terrorism and was part of the legal team that successfully challenged the Bush administration's use of military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay, challenging the U.S. government's surveillance and detention of terrorism suspects. As you know, former Vice President Dick Cheney is going to be addressing the Bush administration's policy in Guantanamo right after the president speaks today. So that's an interesting part of this. And also interesting news yesterday that a top Al-Qaeda suspect held at Guantanamo Bay is going to be sent to New York for trial, according to an Obama administration who made this announcement yesterday. He would be the first Guantanamo detainee brought to the United States and the first to face trial in a civilian criminal court. And this would be for the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa. So all that this hour, we'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We got all bases covered this morning. Rhonda Fanning is monitoring the president's speech, and everybody's still waiting for the president, so he has not begun his address yet. Professor Stephen Vladek, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
So what is the basic problem here? Is everybody worried that these detainees are going to wind up in the backyard of the average citizen in Milwaukee and Colorado and New York, or what?
Well, I mean, that's certainly what some people in Congress are certainly worried about, is the notion that, you know, there's no political constituency for bringing any of these individuals into their districts. And by that logic, there's no constituency to bring them into any district. So, you know, part of it is, how do you sort of unring the bell and how do you sort of walk back from the problem that the Bush administration created by holding at one time as many as 750 people at Guantanamo?
Mm-hmm. There are how many there now? 240? Is that a correct figure?
It's probably very close. I mean, you know, the Defense Department tends not to be precise, but near as we can tell, the number is somewhere around 240. You know, there are news reports every week about new detainees who are being sent home or who are at least being cleared for release to be sent home. So that number is a bit of a sort of moving target, because with every week there are a few more detainees who will be released and repatriated. We just heard this week of the release of Lakhdar Boumediene, who was the lead plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court decision from last year. So it's down to around 240, although I think it's not going to change substantially until the administration comes up with a new sort of systematic plan.
And all of those people who were released were held there for a number of years with no good reason?
Well, I mean, I think that's a matter of debate. I think there's a real concern that many of the folks who have been released so far were held with no good reason. You know, one of the tricky things is that the burden on the government has shifted as these cases have worked their way through the court. So, you know, it wasn't really until 2005 that any of these cases required the government to actually go before a judge and make their case for why they could hold specific individual detainees. As those cases have unfolded in the past 3 years, we've seen how weak at least the public record is in many of these cases. Now, you know, the Bush administration would repeatedly claim that there was all this information they had on some of these folks that they couldn't release to the public, and that's why it's sort of a he said, she said problem.
Mm-hmm. The president, when he announced the closing of Guantanamo, did this just a couple days into his presidency. It was a big part of his campaign. He obviously feels strongly about this issue. He seemed to have support for it. And then all of a sudden it evaporated. Did he not give us a very detailed plan? Well, I know he's going to in a moment here, but was that part of the problem? No details?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, I remember saying to some friends back in January when he ordered the closing of Guantanamo, you know, it's a wonderful symbolic move, but the devil's in the details. Mm. You know, the question was always going to be, what do you do with everyone who is still there? Because closing Guantanamo is a symbolic move, you know, but the real question is, are you going to end the program of preventive detention of enemy combatants or not? Because so long as we are going to hold terrorism suspects without charges anywhere in the world, I think these legal questions are going to recur. Guantanamo is just window dressing for where you do it.
And what is his policy on that? Are you going to, is he going to end preventive detention?
You know, he has been very careful to say no. You know, in various court filings in the last couple of months, the new Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Holder, has taken, I think, what could be fairly described as a more nuanced approach to the question of what makes an individual detainable as an enemy combatant. But they've been very clear that they continue to believe that the government has at least some authority to detain non-citizen terrorism suspects without charges. And I think so long as they believe that, you know, not everyone is going to be happy. There will be human rights and civil liberties groups on the left saying they cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have the former vice president giving a rebuttal to whatever President Obama is going to say. What is he likely to defend? The Bush administration policy in Guantanamo, which was substantially different?
I suspect that will be part of it. Vice President Cheney's also been very vocal in the last few weeks in defending the use of what he would call enhanced interrogation techniques, what more and more people would call torture, at least vis-a-vis some of the Guantanamo detainees. But I also suspect that the Vice President Cheney will point out that as time goes on, you know, the Obama administration's policy looks more and more like the Bush administration's policy. Now, I think that's an unfair charge, but that is an argument that is being advanced increasingly by defenders and supporters of the Bush administration, you know, that things actually haven't changed all that much.
Mm-hmm. And you say that's an unfair charge. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it depends on what kind of change we're talking about. I think it is true at the abstract level that the Obama administration appears to still believe that there is a power to preventively detain certain terrorism suspects, that they believe that there are some individuals who can even be tried by military commissions, and that these folks, you know, don't have the full panoply of protections that U.S. citizens and, you know, non-citizens who are legally in the United States do. But I think the comparisons end there. I mean, I think the Bush administration's, you know, policy approach was based on an extremely broad view of the president's constitutional authority. It was based on the notion that there is no role for the courts to play in any of these cases. And I think neither of those are at all hallmarks of the Obama administration's view. They very much believe that Congress has a lot to say. And they very much believe that at the end of the day, the question of whether individuals are lawfully detained is for the courts. And I think that's a rather significant distinction.
Mm-hmm. We also had news yesterday that this top al-Qaeda suspect who's being held at Guantanamo is going to be sent to New York for trial, probably in the fall, I believe, a major step in his plan to close the detention center. Is there opposition to his being tried in New York? It is a civilian criminal court. Can you tell me what that is? And is this will there be opposition to this guy being tried in New York?
Sure. Well, his name is Ahmed Gailani, and he's a Tanzanian who was actually indicted in 1998, so 3 years before 9/11, for his alleged role in the embassy bombings in Kenya and in Tanzania back in 1998. He was picked up in 2004. He was sent to Guantanamo as one of the high-value detainees in 2006. And so in a way, you know, his case is actually a little bit easier. There was already an indictment pending against him before 9/11. It's still pending. And the federal, you know, the federal criminal court in Manhattan clearly has jurisdiction over the crimes with which he is charged. The problem with his case is that it is unique, that for most of the folks who are still at Guantanamo, there are problems with regard to what crimes they can be charged with regard to where the evidence is, with regard to whether the statutes they will be charged with violating even apply to conduct outside the United States. And so I think, you know, Gailani is actually a bit of an easier case for transferring the detainees to normal criminal trials than many of the folks who are still at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the role of hearsay evidence? I know people were talking about that yesterday.
Sure. I mean, so the hearsay issue has come up particularly in the context of military commissions. The administration has signaled a willingness to revisit the use of military commission proceedings to try some of the suspects. And the idea is that military commissions don't come with all of the procedural niceties of regular criminal courts. And one of the ways in which they are different, at least under a statute Congress passed in 2006 called the Military Commissions Act, is that there is more room for hearsay evidence when someone basically testifies about what somebody else told him to come in than in a typical criminal case. There's more room for evidence obtained through coercion to come in a military commission proceeding than in a typical criminal case. And so, you know, opponents of the military commission proceedings point out that it's not exactly justice to create a separate system with weaker rules simply so that it's easier to convict these people.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and, you know, I'm not a student of the law, but it seems to me if you have just a handful, maybe a few more than that, of hardcore terrorists in Guantanamo, why wouldn't you want to bring all of them and try them in courts here in the United States, civilian criminal courts, and make a big deal out of it, show the American justice system this is how it works, show the world how this system works, and then, you know, if these people are guilty, then they're behind prison doors for the rest of their lives.
I mean, I think there are a lot of people who share that sentiment, Kathleen. I think, you know, I would probably include myself as one of them. I think the problem is that there are logistical problems that arise when you try to, you know, go after these guys in criminal court. For example, suppose that the evidence that we need to convict them is in the possession of a foreign intelligence service, and the foreign intelligence service won't, you know, won't give it over if it means it might be revealed in a public courtroom in Manhattan. You know, I think a lot of these concerns are overblown, but not all of them. And so that's why I think, you know, there's increasingly pressure on the administration to deal with most of the cases this way, right, to move most of the 240 Guantanamo detainees into the normal criminal process. But that's not going to work for everybody. And the question really becomes, what do you do in the hard cases? Now, the Bush administration's response was that all of these are hard cases. And I think that's the critical difference. You know, there's a lot more nuance here. I suspect when the president speaks later this morning, one of the things he's going to say is that, you know, there are a lot fewer of these hard cases than we initially thought, but there are still some. And it's the hard cases that I think are really what is so troubling right now.
Mm-hmm. And I still don't understand why it's taken 7 years to sort all this out.
Well, a big part of the problem, you know, a big part of the blame for that has to be placed with Congress. I mean, after September 18th, 2001, when Congress passed a statute known as the Authorization for Use of Military Force, Congress was silent on the question of detention of terrorism suspects, basically for almost 5 years. And when Congress finally did come back into play in 2005 and 2006, they didn't actually authorize anything. They just tried to cut the courts out of the loop. And so there was all this litigation for basically 4 or 5 years about whether the courts would have the final say. Last summer in the Boumediene decision, the Supreme Court finally said yes. Congress cannot put us out of the loop, and it's only been in the aftermath of that decision that these questions have finally gotten to the forefront, that, you know, the courts have finally been able to do what so many lawyers had been asking them to do really since January of 2002.
We're going to welcome phone calls. The president will be speaking on this issue, and it should be happening beginning at least sometime during this hour, but we're monitoring the speech, so we'll pass along what it is that the president is saying he is to be delivering today. According to his press secretary, a hefty part of his plan for the closing of Guantanamo, which, as you know, has run into problems. Yesterday, the Senate Democratic leaders say they would not provide the $80 million that he requested to close the facility, and everybody's asking for more details. The former vice president is going to essentially be giving a response to what the president says 2 minutes after he gives his address. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Professor Stephen Vladeck, Associate Professor, American University's Washington College of Law. And he has been very actively involved in this whole issue. He was part of the legal team that successfully challenged the Bush administration's use of military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, a listener request which came from our last open line. A leading nationwide health institute calls Wisconsin its home at the National Wellness Institute at UW-Stevens Point, and we'll be talking with the co-founder of the institute about wellness, holistic wellness. All right, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, but still one line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. Jim from Galena, our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for the conversation, and thanks, Professor. I'm in my 70s. I've been following this since the September 11th situation that we run into. And early on, in 2002, 2003, 2004, part of the problem that this government has is they were paying individuals to turn in terrorists. $5,000 to $10,000 a piece. Well, that's more money than they make in 2 years over there. So naturally, there's a lot of those individuals that were turned in as terrorists that were innocent that were just turned in for the money. I think that the fact that it's only 200 and some left, and there's been 500 or 400 and some already released, bears that out. But in any case, I don't know how this government can display our justice system and keep individuals, young boys, young individuals, in prison or in jail for 7 years without ever trying them or bringing charges against them. That's, I think, the only way to straighten this out, in my opinion, would be to appoint an individual counsel and get into the whole mess of torture, the detainees, and everything else. Take it out of politics and let somebody investigate it and bring charges where charges need to be brought.
Professor.
Well, I mean, I think Jim's exactly right about the concern about paying individuals to turn in terrorism suspects. That was certainly one of the allegations in the case of Yasser Hamdi, a U.S. citizen who was captured by the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. But I do think we have to keep in mind there are some bad guys, at Guantanamo, and I think the Bush administration and its supporters have never been wrong to suggest that some of the people who are in U.S. custody mean to do grave harm to the United States. The issue is, how do we separate out the bad guys from the guys who are just in the wrong place at the wrong time? And I think for the past 7 years, we've done an admirably poor job of creating procedures that could be effective in either direction. We've released some people who, according to a Defense Department report, have gone back onto the battlefield. We've released other people against whom we never had any evidence. And so I think, the real question is, how do we create a process through which we can try to incapacitate the people who, would do the most harm to the United States while avoiding the problem of rounding up people just because they meet, the wrong description, just because they're one of the usual suspects? That is the challenge for the Obama administration.
So how should we do that?
Well, I mean, I think, they've made some signs that they're on the right track. One of the first things President Obama ordered was the creation of this joint task force on detainee policy that was going to review every single case on an individualized basis, that was going to make sure there was actually enough information, enough evidence in the file to support the continuing detention of these individuals. And I think the more individualized the process is, and the more chance that these detainees have to confront the evidence against them, to have lawyers helping them make their case, I think the more likely it is that the process is going to be accurate.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it the president who said this or who said this? And I wonder if he'll say this as part of his plan today. There have been great problems with the accused being able to get any kind of counsel. And then what I was hearing yesterday was that part of the plan is for the accused to have greater decision, their own decision making in choosing counsel, and could be able to choose a lawyer that they wanted. Is that right?
I think that's rumored to be part of the plan. I think, you know, concerns about access to counsel have been there from the forefront. The Bush administration did not let any of the Guantanamo detainees meet with any outside representatives, let alone lawyers, until 2004, by which point many of them had been there for 2.5 years. And a lot of the detainees simply don't trust their lawyers, and for good reason. These are people who they don't have enough information to assess the credibility of. These are people who seem to be coming from the same government that's responsible for their current plight. So I think, you know, the more flexibility they have in finding lawyers who they are comfortable with, the better they'll be able to make the case, you know, if they are the wrong person, right? If they are someone who really was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And as I said before, I think the real touchstone has to be accuracy. How do we create an accurate process if we're going to have any process to ensure that we're not holding the wrong people?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Earl is next from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. Great topic. I wanted to ask the professor for some facts here or his information, because it seems like Congress is relying mostly on emotions here, but that there's already some very nasty people in our prisons. I think the Oklahoma City bombers were kept in our prisons, and spies and very despicable people, these supermax places. So why is Congress just caving in on not having any in our justice system? And then also it's been mentioned, but I think it could be mentioned again, there have been a lot of people through Guantanamo, and I've seen very little documentation that very many or a large percent were distinct threats to this country.
Well, Earl, to your first point, I mean, I think that's a very good point. It's one that Senator Feinstein went out of her way to make during the debates yesterday and the day before. I mean, it's a reality that I think a lot of us aren't too often exposed to, that our supermax facilities, especially the one in Florence, Colorado, don't actually look that different insofar as conditions of confinement from the current state of affairs at Guantanamo. Now, you know, some human rights advocates would say, well, all the more reason to improve the conditions of, you know, our own prison systems. But I think it does give credence to the argument that, you know, we can incapacitate these people, that if the real concern is that simply by bringing them into a federal prison in the United States, we are risking, you know, some kind of new danger, that seems to be belied to a large degree by the identity of those folks who were already holding there. Richard Reed, the alleged shoe bomber, or I should say the convicted shoe bomber, is at Florence, right? Zacharias Moussaoui, Jose Padilla is in a federal prison. I mean, I think we've already shown a willingness and a capacity to hold some of the most dangerous terrorism suspects in these prisons. I think now it's mostly a not-in-my-backyard problem more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. It hasn't been a case, have we heard any stirrings from members of Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world that we're going to get you because these guys are in your prisons and they shouldn't be?
Well, I mean, FBI Director Mueller testifying before Congress yesterday made a point rather similar to that. I mean, he said simply having these folks in the U.S. will increase the possibility that Al-Qaeda will look to attack the United States. You know, that strikes me as, I mean, he's the FBI director, I'm just a law professor, but that strikes me as rather unsubstantiated. You know, it's entirely possible that Al-Qaeda is emboldened by the fact that we're continuing to hold these folks at Guantanamo. And I don't know that moving them to the most secure prison we've ever built is going to increase anything other than, you know, our moral reputation on the world stage.
Right. The president is just getting started, and we will be monitoring his speech, so we'll get instantaneous reaction to it from our guest. Earl, thanks for your call. We go to John from Burlington next. Hi, John.
Good morning. My question is Cheney's response, is this typical of a VP that's out of office? And, you know, is it right to even give him this platform to respond 2 minutes after the president's speech when, you know, he's really, you know, what's the difference? I mean, he when he was in office, we couldn't find him, and he didn't want to talk about anything.
It is strange,
his way or the highway, you know.
Yeah,
so now he wants to, you know, talk. I'm just curious as to, is it really the media's, you know, responsibility to give him that platform?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a great point. I mean, I'm no expert on the media, and Kathleen may be better situated to address that than I.
I'm no expert either.
but my only reaction is, you know, there are lots of ways in which Vice President Cheney is without precedent in the annals of American history, or at least we might have to go back to Vice President Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, becomes president. But I do think, and I don't mean that in a good way, but I do think that, you know, Vice President Cheney has stepped up in recent weeks, perhaps to provide cover to Republicans in Congress who are less comfortable being the national face on this issue, because I think he suspects that now is the time when this fight is happening, right? That now is the time when Americans all over are engaged in a very serious, and I do think very principled debate about how to simultaneously keep our country safe and free. I think the really sad part is that that debate is taking place now, after 8 years of administration that never seemed to want to have that discussion.
Hmm. And you do wonder, why didn't he just run for president if he's going to take this role? It's very odd, I think. It's just very odd.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to inquire after his motives, but I do think that from the vice president's perspective, nobody else is doing it.
Right.
And so, right. You know, if nobody else is going to take on the current administration, you know, who better than him? After all, what's the worst that could happen? You know, I suspect that that's a bad precedent to set, where previous administrations put themselves in the role of chief critic of the current administration. That being said, you know, it's his pulpit, and if the media wants to cover it, who am I to,
sure,
you know, to do anything other than change the channel?
Yeah, right. Thanks very much for the call, John. Alan is next from Westby. Hi, Alan.
Hey, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate
sure.
it. Great show. I've got 2 points here I'd like to make. First off, our former president made the decision to put these folks at Guantanamo, and essentially he made our bed, and now we have to sleep in it. And if that means we have to bring these people to America and put them in our prisons, then that's our job. That's what we need to do. The second point that I see here is this is a tremendous opportunity for our Muslim brothers and sisters out there to reach out to these people and show them what America is truly all about, and to give them an opportunity to see that we're not the evil empire, that there is great opportunity, that we're a forgiving nation, and that there are good things here, and that maybe we can bring them in the fold and turn them around. We've seen that happen before in the past. Look at World War II, when a lot of German prisoners of war were shipped to America, and they lived here, they worked here, and then when it came time to go back to Germany, they said, heck no, I'm staying.
Well, I mean, I think those are some great points. You know, the World War II example is tricky, of course, because as well as we treated the German POWs who were here, our record, you know, with the Japanese-American internment camps isn't quite so good. The larger point, though, right, that this is our own problem and that we should bear the burden of solving it, I think is indisputable. There's one case that's been flying somewhat beneath the radar, at least among the national media, which involves 17 Uyghurs. These are Chinese Muslims who were picked up in Pakistan in the fall of 2001, who have been adjudicated to be not enemy combatants. You know, 3 different federal courts have now said that the only thing these guys were doing was training to fight against China, and that they mean no harm to the United States. The problem is that there's nowhere to release them. And so even though these 17 guys are not capable of legally being detained at Guantanamo, we can't send them back to China because they credibly fear being tortured there. And no, you know, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington has said we cannot order their release into the United States because the courts don't have the power to do that. So talk about a problem of our own creation. They're only at Guantanamo because we picked them up off the battlefield, and yet, you know, the solution, which seems to be releasing them into the United States, is one for which there seems to be no constituency. You know, this is a trap of our own making, and I think what we have to keep in mind is that part of what President Obama is doing in his speech today is not saying what he would have done had it been up to him from the beginning, but rather how he thinks we can best fix the mess that we made over the past 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Alan, for your call. Megan is next from Rockford, Illinois. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great. You know, I have a number of views on this topic, and, you know, it's mixed with my own ethical standings and what I believe in, and then balanced by the fact that I know that we don't live in a utopian world. So I think that when the Obama administration, you know, voiced their views, I think that it was really based on a more idyllic world, and that, you know, we wanted to reach further than what the previous administration had from a humanitarian aspect. And then the harsh reality kind of sinks in, and we have to backtrack a little bit because we can't have, you know, a perfect world. My original question was kind of addressed by the last caller, and that is that I'd like to know historically how often it's happened in the past that countries have gone beyond their shores, captured individuals that they felt were working against their country's values, and just, you know, how, is that something that historically has happened time and time again? It just seems odd to me that we could have the power to do that.
Well, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think it depends on whether we're talking about wartime examples or not. There's certainly very little precedent, although I should say not none, for the notion that countries can capture suspects, criminal suspects, terrorism suspects, extraterritorially during peacetime. But, you know, wars are different. I mean, I think, you know, no one would have raised too much of a stink if during World War II we had captured, you know, Hermann Göring while he was traveling in some third-party country, on the theory that he was clearly a combatant, that he was clearly, you know, liable to be arrested and captured during wartime. And I think part of the problem all along has been that we've never had this serious conversation about to what extent this really is a war. Congress authorized the use of military force in September of 2001 and has said very little since. And I think we have to sort of grapple with the question of whether we really are involved in this worldwide military operation that allows for anyone to be arrested at any time. That, to me, is a rather disturbing prospect. And I doubt very much that it's what Congress intended to authorize, you know, 4 days, 5 days after 9/11. So there's precedent. I'm not sure it's particularly good precedent. And I think, you know, there are lots of ways in which the problems posed by al-Qaeda really are unique and require unprecedented kinds of solutions. That being said, that's no reason to sort of, you know, start over and throw away all the rules we've created. I mean, Justice Frankfurter once said our most important procedural safeguards were made for cases involving not very nice people. Hmm. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we have this national debate.
Yeah, interesting. Let me give you a little bit of what the president has said here. The decisions that he said, President Obama, that were made over the last 8 years established an ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable, a framework that failed to rely on our legal traditions and time-tested institutions, that failed to use our values as a compass, and that is why I took several steps upon taking office to better protect the American people.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that says it right off the top. I mean, I think, you know, the new administration's approach is markedly different from the old, simply in its application. That the Obama administration wants to take a case by case, individualized approach to make sure that for each person we're holding at Guantanamo, you know, we're asking the right questions. Whereas I think the Bush administration's approach was, you know, pick up everybody who looks suspicious and sort them out later. And I think, you know, that although those have the same sort of theories behind them, they are markedly different in application. And I think that's part of why, you know, these critiques of the administration that's just repeating the Bush administration policies, at least to me, ring so hollow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Megan, for your call. 800-486-8655. Steve from Oxford is next. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. I was watching a scene on television a while back where a couple of soldiers were sitting in a roadside cafe, and a car pulls up, and two guys in civilian dress jump out and pull out machine guns and just riddle these soldiers with bullets. Now, the only problem was, what I was watching was the movie called The Great Escape, and it was the James Coburn scene, and the soldiers who got murdered were Germans, and the civilians who shot them were French resistance fighters. And I think this is, there's a lot of parallels to what's going on now, except that now it's the Americans who are being killed and not the Germans. Do you see where I'm going here?
Sure. I mean, Steve, I think that's a fair point. I think the issue is one that is actually not that new. It's the idea of irregular warfare, where, you know, on one side you have a regularly constituted military force of a state actor, and on the other side you have a loosely organized group that's not directly affiliated with any country. And I think, you know, the Bush administration and its defenders for a long time harped on the idea that, you know, Al-Qaeda would never treat our captured soldiers the way that human rights groups want us to treat theirs. And I think reciprocity is not really the issue here, right? The question is, are you going to follow the rules entirely so that when other countries don't, when other actors don't, we can say they're wrong, right? Now, I realize that this sounds like an incredibly abstract and ideal view, right, and that it has deleterious consequences for our troops on the ground. The problem is that that's what moral, you know, leadership is all about. It's about taking the high road. And I think for too long, in the 8 years since, you know, the 9/11 attacks, we've abandoned that. We've abandoned the moral high ground in favor of expediency. And that's why, you know, I think it's so important to have more nuance here. Not because anybody believes that we should do things that make us less safe, but because I think, you know, there's a fervent belief that there is just, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. We can simultaneously be safe and adhere to our legal traditions.
Thanks very much for the call. The president in his speech is talking, and I think this is an interesting point. There's things happen so rapidly, you forget what's been said, and but we've followed this very closely, and I remember talking with a number of terrorism experts, and the president mentioned this in his address just moments ago, that Guantanamo has become a symbol, or helped become a symbol, that helped al-Qaeda recruit terrorists to his cause. The president says, indeed, the existence of Guantanamo likely created more terrorists around the world than it ever detained. What do you think?
I mean, you know, I think that's, you know, it's nice rhetoric. I don't know that we'd ever be able to prove it, but I think it does make the point that one of the things we sacrifice when we subvert fundamental legal values and when we subvert, you know, our fundamental beliefs in the name of national security is the ability to say, here's why we are different from everybody else, right? Here's what sets us apart on the world stage. And I think Guantanamo has been an enormous black eye on our reputation in that regard, as have the torture allegations, as was the Abu Ghraib scandal. You know, so part of the question is, how do we, going forward, simultaneously do what we need to do to incapacitate these dangerous terrorism suspects without sacrificing our ability to lead on the international stage?
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655 as the president gives his address, and we are monitoring his address about what to do, to what plans need to be in place to close Guantanamo. Members of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are concerned about this very issue, and as a result, Senate Democrats voting yesterday to not provide the $80 million that he requested to close this facility. So he's giving a very detailed speech at this moment talking about those plans. Professor Stephen Vladek is our guest, associate professor, American University Washington College of Law, and was part of the legal team that successfully challenged the Bush administration's use of military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to your phone calls. Anne from Madison, hi.
Hi. I think that Portugal has offered to take detainees, except the ones who were known to be really dangerous. But I don't believe most of these guys belong in any prison at all, not here, not anywhere else. If no evidence has been collected against people who began as bakers, for instance, and were picked up in Afghanistan on $5,000 bounties, what information could they possibly have had about someone like Osama bin Laden or any member of the al-Qaeda? It would be like arresting me because a neighbor with a grudge was offered $50,000 if they claimed I had been part of a national murder ring. And once arrested, if I had been strung up and beaten to a pulp and waterboarded, all the while being questioned about my non-existent part in the national crime ring. And if I were questioned by torturers who didn't speak anything except Arabic, and who asked only leading questions over and over again, what information could I provide? So, you know, I think that when Obama surrounded himself with members of the Bush administration, especially Gates, and his whole ring of, you know, military guys who have something to hide, and when Congress kept the same old leaders who had colluded with the outrages of the Bush administration, that's where Obama is seriously erring, and he sounds very reasonable, but his actions are not reasonable.
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem with this whole conversation, the national conversation, is that there's all this information that we as the public, you know, simply aren't privy to. I mean, I have no doubt that there are any number of detainees who meet, you know, very close to that description, who really were just, you know, on the wrong list, or their name was, you know, misspelled, and so we got to the wrong person. You know, the problem is that for every one of those, there may well be one or two detainees for whom we have incredibly compelling evidence that we just cannot, you know, reveal publicly. And I think part of the problem here is that trust, right, becomes a major part of this conversation. How far do we trust that the administration, that the government is acting in the best interest, right, is actually not holding someone simply because there's no information, is doing what they believe they have to do? And I think part of what happened over the past 7 or 8 years is that the Bush administration, you know, lost the trust of the American people. And I think the question is, how can the new administration regain and rebuild that trust such that when they say, listen, we can't tell you why we have to keep this guy here, but trust us, we need to, you know, we actually might be inclined to believe them, because I think right now we're not.
Mm-hmm. The president talked a few moments ago about ordering a review of all the pending cases at Guantanamo, and then talked about the years that these detainees have spent in legal limbo. I'm wondering about the review of the cases. Do you have any information about the review that took place? Who took the review? It seems to me as though we've spent years talking about who's there and where they came from and whether or not they might be terrorists. Why don't we know who they are?
Well, I think, I mean, part of the problem, Kathleen, is that I think, you know, different agencies had different information. And so one of the things that this Joint Task Force on Detainee Policy was supposed to do was to collate everything, right, was to make sure that there was one file that actually had every piece of information related to the detention of each individual suspect and each individual detainee at Guantanamo. Because you have different intelligence agencies and different, you know, governmental operations who would all say, we have different information on these people. So it's when you put together what the FBI has with what the CIA has, with what the Defense Department has, you know, and the NSA, that maybe you can actually create a picture that shows either that this person really is a bad guy or that he isn't. So I think one of the things that this Joint Task Force has been doing, and they have been working rather diligently, I think, for the last 3 months, has been trying to actually make sure all the information's in one place before actually making decisions about which individual detainees can be held, you know, should be held, I should say, and which can be released and repatriated. And I think, you know, that to me is responsible. I think what's sad is that it took us 8 years to get there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ann, very much for your call. Let's go to Jean from Alcorn. Hi, Jean.
Yes, good morning. Great show. I'm glad to hear the topic. My major news television channels are not covering Obama's speech at all, so that's very disappointing. I was kind of wondering if the professor could speak to the burden of proof that the defendants would have to prove versus a military tribunal courtroom versus a federal courtroom. And are my senators putting that into their calculations in these rejections or denying the monies to and to me, it seems like a little bit of the cart before the horse here. Don't we have to try them and then decide where they go?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think there's a lot of carts being put before a lot of horses here, and I think that's part of the reason for the president's speech today is to actually start adding substance to this conversation. With regard to the specifics of military commission trials, the burden of proof is actually technically the same, which is to say the burden is on the government in a military commission to establish that the defendant committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is that the way they do that is markedly different. So the defendant's access to counsel, for example, is less unfettered in the military commission context than it is in a normal trial. The evidence that the government gets to use to attempt to satisfy that burden is markedly different. We talked a little bit earlier in the hour about hearsay and about the potential use of coerced testimony. Indeed, the jury is different. In a military commission, the jury is not members of the public at large. The jury is, you know, to the extent there even is a jury, the jury is members of the military, and the presiding judge is a military officer. Now, this is not to impugn the military justice system at large. We have a fine military justice system, but there are all kinds of ways in which the military commissions actually deviate from that system in ways that tilt the scale toward the government and away from the defendants.
Wonderful answer. Do you enter the system with more rights as a citizen? You know, obviously some of these, you know, are from overseas. They're not citizens. Do they come to a federal court system with more citizen rights?
Well, I mean, let me put it this way: it's basically unquestioned that a defendant in a federal criminal, in a federal civilian criminal trial, so in a run-of-the-mill, you know, federal criminal trial in your local federal district court, that all defendants have the same procedural rights at least once the trial begins, that no two defendants have different due process rights, that no two defendants have different rights with regard to access to counsel. The only real difference that matters based upon who the defendant is might go to the admission of evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment, because there are some court decisions that say that the Fourth Amendment, at least, which protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures, doesn't actually apply to non-citizens outside the United States. That's a pretty big difference, but otherwise, in most material respects, you know, people would have the same rights. I think the real issue is that, you know, with regard to, it's not simply, you know, civilian court versus military commission. There's a third possibility. Well, I should say there are a couple other possibilities. But one other possibility is to try them, you know, in a military court that looks just like our courts martial. You know, the process we use to try our own service members when they commit crimes. That would allow the government a little more security. It would have slightly better procedures for the use of sensitive national security information, while at the same time, you know, showing the world that we're not treating these individuals any different than we treat our own soldiers who we allege, you know, have committed crimes. I think that, to me, is an equally attractive option that deserves more discussion.
And I'm not sure, we're monitoring the president as we speak. I'm not sure he's mentioned three possibilities here in the last couple moments. When feasible, and it would be interesting to talk about what that means, we will try those who have violated American criminal laws in federal courts, courts provided for by the United States Constitution. The second category involves detainees who violate the laws of war and are best tried through military commissions. The third category includes those who have been ordered released by the courts. Let me repeat what I said earlier. This has absolutely nothing to do with my decision to close Guantanamo. It has to do with the rule of law.
Well, I think, you know, that's a telling statement. I mean, I think a lot of what has prompted all of this maneuvering over the past couple of months have been the flurry of judicial decisions, most by the federal district court sitting here in my hometown of Washington, D.C., that has basically been saying, listen, you guys have been doing nothing. You know, you guys, meaning Congress and the executive branch, these people have rights. It's time that they actually get to vindicate those rights. And so I think part of what we're seeing is the Obama administration caught between the rock that the Bush administration left for them and the hard place that is, you know, the federal courts.
Thanks very much. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Robert from Kaluma. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Hello to both of you. I have a question that somebody should ask Dick Cheney. If he does not consider waterboarding a torture and it's acceptable behavior, would he be willing to undergo it on himself, say, on presented on TV? Someone should ask him if he would be willing to undergo this procedure, this harmless procedure.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, even Vice President Cheney has never suggested that it's harmless. But I do think it's important. I mean, the torture conversation is one that I think we also have to have. But I do think it's important to try to keep these two conversations distinct. The torture conversation really is one about, the limits of the rule of law and how far we will go to adhere to what really are bright line constraints on the government's power, even during wartime. You know, the conversation that's gone on the last week is a bit distinct, and it's really a question about, you know, not sort of what we've done in the past and what the Bush administration might be responsible for, but what we are going to do going forward. It has similar principles behind it, but I think it's a more political question about what is the best policy for simultaneously balancing our commitment to the rule of law with a desire to ensure that nothing like 9/11 ever happens again. Mm. And I think that is the predicament that any administration of any ideological stripe would find itself in, and that's why I think it's encouraging to see the president taking to, you know, really the front pages to have this conversation with the American people, something his predecessor never did.
Right. It really, all of this gets to the heart of who we are in many ways. It's profoundly important and interesting. Thank you, Professor Vladeck, for being with us. It was in for going with the flow of the conversation for the president at the same time we were talking. I appreciate your expertise.
Thanks, Kathleen. It's my pleasure.
Professor Stephen Vladeck, Associate Professor, American University, Washington College of Law. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the hour, and for Rhonda Fanning for monitoring what the president was saying, and to you, of course, for all of your wonderful calls. So that's it for the first hour, but we have another hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.